Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, and Senior Director of the JPC and your host. As many of you know, and there are a lot of you in the audience today, so I'm really happy. As many of you know, the JPC is a 501c3 organization that provides analysis of foreign and domestic policy from experts, academics, and commentators. You can find our work, insight articles, in Focus Quarterly, and our blogs on the website at jewishpolicycenter.org. The new issue of In Focus Quarterly is up as of yesterday and after a slight delay for the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Jewish holidays. As an institution and as individuals, we in the JPC support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. And we worry a lot. In these programs, we have gone around the world, from Israel to China, to South America to Azerbaijan. We have been from Turkey to Iran in the countries of the Persian Gulf. We've been appalled by China and Iran, and we've been thrilled by the parties to the Abraham Accords. Today, we're not doing a country, we're doing a theme, anti-Zionism and its kissing cousin, anti-Semitism. The Abraham Accords gave us hope that Israel would finally get the legitimacy and security and the secure and recognized boundaries free from threats or acts of force that are at the center of UN Resolution 242. And there's no denying the changes in the region. But the fact remains that since Zionism became a political philosophy in the 19th century, the idea of reestablishing the Jewish national home in its ancient land has been under assault from within the region and from outside the region, and never far removed from the hatred of the Jewish people. Today, I am thrilled to introduce Richard Heidemann, a man who has spent his entire professional and civic career working for the security and strength of Israel and the Jewish people. Now, let me say at the outset that if I fully introduced Richard, there wouldn't be any time left for him to speak. So whatever I say, please understand that there is more, there is a lot more that I'm not gonna say in favor of letting him talk, not me. Richard Heidemann's firm serves as lead counsel representing American victims of terrorism in claims against Libya, Syria, Iran, the PLO, and other organizations and financial institutions. The firm has been awarded multi-million and billion-dollar judgments against Iran and Syria. And the firm has represented numerous victims of terrorism before the U.S. Foreign Claims Settlement Commission and its counsel to American victims of terrorism against the Arab Bank. In his civic career, Richard has served as president of B'nai B'rith International, and he was named by the organization as honorary president. He was an NGO delegate to the UN World Conference on Women, head of delegation to the UN World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, and then head of delegation to the UN Durban Review Commission in Geneva, and the chairman of the UN Durban 10-year assessment event. We need to have him talk about Durban. He was chief trial counsel for Israeli victims of terrorism at hearings convened by the Dutch Center for Information and documentation on Israel, coincident with the International Court of Justice hearings at The Hague. He authored the legal brief filed with the International Court of Justice on behalf of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies regarding legal issues arising from Israel's construction of a security fence and Israel's right to defend its citizens from terrorism. He's been listed in a veritable who's who of who's who lists, including who's who in the East, who's who in America, in the world, in American law, and in finance and industry. These are capabilities he's taken to the American Zionist Movement, the Israel Forever Foundation, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum Lawyers Committee, the Institute for Law and Policy at Hebrew University's Faculty of Law. In addition, the Herzliya Conference, International Advisory Board, ADL, Hillel, the World Zionist Organization, the Jewish Agency for Israel, and AIPAC have also had the benefit of his hard work and his insights. Remember what I said, listing some things means I'm not listing other things. But through it all, Richard has found time to publish two books. The outstanding The Hague Odyssey, which you really need to go and buy, and the just published The Bloody Price of Freedom, which is what brings us to this program, anti-Semitism being an eternal subject. But the mechanisms of anti-Semitism and support for it do change. So they require generation after generation of understanding to marshal our resources and fight back. We are about to learn something. Richard Heidemann, the floor is yours.
Shoshana, thank you very much. And thank you for what you do and have done for so long with the Jewish Policy Center, seeing to it that not only do we talk about important issues of the day, but we put them in the context of the past. Because if we can understand the past, we can learn more about the future and perhaps change direction. I'm indeed honored to be here as a presenter for the second time, because when the book, The Hague Odyssey was published, you invited me to the offices. Today, we're in our virtual offices and we're all looking forward to getting back to shall we say, normalization. But what we know about the past is that there is indeed an entire approach that is what I call a perpetuation of hate. We can see it today in a meteoric rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism, but it did not start just a few years ago or even a few decades ago. We're going to cover today a look back, not at thousands of years, not at 3,000 years of Jewish history, not at our ancestral rights to lands. I'm only going to take us back about 100 years. In 1920, the Nazi 25-point manifesto was developed and was pronounced and was adopted. And from a public source, we have learned that the Nazi Party will fight the Jewish self-interest spirit and believes that the nation will be strongest only if everyone puts the common interest before self-interest. Only Germans may be citizens of Germany. No Jew may be a citizen. Crimes against the common interest must be punished with death. And as a result, it's very clear that there was a concentration to focus on the Jewish community, on each Jewish individual as the enemy of the state of Germany. And the state became the embodiment of state-sponsored hate. Take a look at the Third Reich in 1933, where they launched an issue we hear about today, a Jewish boycott. In 1933, stormtroopers raided buildings. They put Jude on the windows. They barred Jews from holding public office. They had a day-long nationwide Jewish business boycott. They saw to it that Jewish government workers and teachers would be fired, and laws targeting Jewish lawyers and doctors were enacted. We see contemporary comparisons today because we've all heard members of Congress calling for the boycott, members of Congress tolerating anti-Semitism, members of Congress and high members of the government blinking an eye, giving a nod to those who choose to spew hate and calling it free speech. It doesn't work. We have to put a stop to it. And let's take a look at what happened when they didn't put a stop to it. I take us from 1933 to 1935, the official adoption of the Reich citizenship law as part of the Nuremberg laws and the law for the protection of German blood and German honor, which banned marriage and relations between Jews and Germans. There was a November 14 decree from the government that created what I refer to again as state-sponsored hate. One of the byproducts of that was that lawyers, for example, were banned from the court system. And the court system became a Nazi propaganda tool. And they supported insidious laws and ludicrous explanations and medieval values, giving duty and honor in service only to those of the Aryan race. You all know about the Holocaust. We all know how horrible it was, how it was indeed the worst moment in the history of the world. And we, the Jewish people, were the focus. We know that over 6 million Jews and countless other innocent people were not only murdered, but the work of the Holocaust Museum and the work of Paul Shapiro at the Holocaust Museum, working with the International Tracing Service, now has brought forth to the public eye 17 million people and over 100 million documents are available today on the internet through the Holocaust Museum, through Yad Vashem, that explains the documented history of what really happened during the Holocaust in the camps, the movement of people, when they were shot, where they were taken, how they were treated. And we know that during the war itself, 2.7 million Jews alone were murdered across 5 killing centers: Belzec, Chelmno, Sobibor, Treblinka, and Auschwitz-Birkenau, all government-sponsored hate. As a result of that government-sponsored hate and the end of the war, the United States decided that something had to be done. And Chief Justice Robert Jackson was assigned by the United States to address the issues, and he worked with Lord Justice Sir Geoffrey Lawrence. They developed 3 options for the Nazi regime: let the atrocities go unpublished, execute or otherwise punish the perpetrators without a hearing, or determine the guilt or innocence of the accused. And they opted for the latter. And witnesses were introduced, and physical evidence was introduced, and prosecutors submitted thousands of German documents, photos, and videos proving that the state-sponsored Nazi regime had carried out the systematic persecution and destruction and attempted decimation of all of European Jewry. The Holocaust is indeed the most extensively documented case of genocide in the world. And as a result of the Nuremberg trials, which was imperfect justice, there was, as a result of the subsequent establishment of the United Nations, there was adopted in 1948, the UN Genocide Convention, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and in 49, the Geneva Convention on the Laws and Customs of War, essential documents in the body of international law. What was it that Justice Jackson said in his opening statement in 1945? A quote worthy of repeating: "The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated." So when we look back 100 years, half those 100 years dealt with the focused attention by the Nazi regime, joined by the collaborators, on the Jewish people, maligning the Jewish people, seeing to it that the Jewish people were painted in the worst possible light, and taking steps toward annihilation. There then came the establishment of the State of Israel, but one must ask, hasn't there been an insidious and multi-pronged attack on Israel? And where does that come from? Did Nazi Germany end? I propose to you today that Nazi Germany was replaced by the Arab League. In October 1944, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon signed the Alexandria Protocol. It led to the formation of the Arab League, and it led to the first formal post-war Israel boycott, boycotting the Zionists. This wasn't new. This isn't just about 2000, 21. This was back in the 40s after the war, and the perpetuation of hate that has continued ever since has been pervasive, and it has led to today's meteoric rise in anti-Semitism. But let's understand it better. 1944, the Arab League established. 45, the Arab League adopts the Zionist boycott. 48, the War of Independence in 48 and 49, following the partition resolution of 47, Israel's declaration of independence in 48, that partition resolution called for the establishment of the Jewish state, the establishment of an Arab state, special status for Jerusalem. That was the UN adopted partition resolution. The Jewish state came into existence, our beloved state of Israel. The Arab state has never come into existence because instead they chose the war of the battlefield. They chose to engage in the War of Independence, the Sinai Campaign in 56, the Six-Day War in 67, the Yom Kippur War in 73. And you have to understand that all of those wars, Israel won. And what happened next? There was an attempt to shift from war on the battlefield to war by other means, war by diplomacy, war by hijacking of international law and diplomacy. Let's take a look at that period following the 73 war. In 1975, the Arab League pressed its bias against Israel at the United Nations by introducing the Zionism equals racism resolution. Now, we all know what's the worst thing that you could be called, that I could be called, that anyone could be called. Maybe you would use another phrase. I will say the worst thing to call somebody, even today, maybe especially today, is a racist. So go back to 1975 and please understand that at the United Nations, Israel was officially called a racist. Israel, one of the full state members of the United Nations, branded as a racist. And that effort was indeed a hijacking of the United Nations, a hijacking of diplomacy. And the battle against the Zionism racism resolution continued. And in 1985, at the UN-sponsored World Conference to assess and appraise the status of women, my wife, Phyllis, who you all know, she's on active with all of us. She's the president of the March of the Living. She previously served as an appointee to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council. But in 1985, she was a delegate of B'nai B'rith International to the UN conference in Nairobi. And we arrived in Nairobi to find the worst possible hateful anti-Semitic situation that we could have imagined on the grounds of the United Nations. Now, we had been prepared for that. We had been briefed by the B'nai B'rith. We had been briefed by the State Department. We were taken with great care and a certain degree of protexia. We arrived in Nairobi and we found this entire hateful experience with placards showing Israel killing children, with placards calling Israel murderers. And in the conference document in Nairobi, there was embedded a reconfirmation of Zionism equals racism. And only because of the leadership of Maureen Reagan, the daughter of President Reagan, who was the head of the US delegation, along with Ambassador Alan Keyes, who was the chief ambassadorial delegate for the United States, only because of their perseverance and instructions directly from the White House, was the threat put out at that conference that if Zionism equals racism remains in the conference outcome document, the United States will walk from the conference. And it was taken out in 1985. And in the 90s, actually, the United Nations abrogated the Zionism equals racism resolution. But fast forward just now to look back 20 years, the UN Conference on Racism held of all places in Durban, South Africa. And while we went there full-hearted, I was president of B'nai B'rith International. I was chair at the time of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, United Nations Committee, and I was designated as head of delegation for the Jewish organizations. We all went to Durban. We went with full hearts in spite of what we knew of the Nairobi Conference. But what we found there on the grounds in Durban was a hate fest that far exceeded Nairobi. They spit at us. They yelled at us, they barred us, they criticized us, and they equated us to being Zionists, Israelis, Jews, all equaling not just racist and apartheid and criminal, but as murderers. And when we together with all the Jewish organizations, with the ambassador from Israel, the ambassador from the United States, walked out of that conference, it was the headline the next day. Jews walk out of conference. Maybe they cared we were there because they certainly cared that we walked out. But what did we leave behind? We left behind the adoption of the Durban Declaration and the Durban Program that has been followed over the last 20 years, supported and sponsored by designated foreign terror organizations, including the plan for boycotts, including the plan for ramping up academic hate on the campuses, included the plan for economic boycotts, included the plan for the isolation of Israel as the pariah of the world. And the UN has celebrated that. In 2009, there was a Durban Review Conference. In 2011, there was the 10-year look back. In 2020, continued activities, and in 2021, the adoption just this year by the United Nations of a resolution that would bring forth last month Durban 4, a commemoration of Durban, a commemoration of Durban to applaud the Durban program and to reinforce the Durban program. And although 38 or 39 countries boycotted the Durban conference of just last month, the Durban program is alive and well. And it has to be looked at in context, because look at the resolutions that the Arab League members sponsored against Israel. A quick look back. 83 new countries admitted, including 14 Arab League members from 1950 to 75. There were four anti-Israel resolutions between 69 and 72, 16 between 73 and 78, 44 in 1982, and 22 anti-Israel resolutions at the United Nations just a year ago in 2020. The United Nations developed specific committees and divisions and has funded them that have fueled the hate at the United Nations against Israel. The Committee on the Exercise of Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People and the Division for Palestinian Rights of the Secretariat. Their job is to promote not just the Palestinian cause, but to promote putting down and castigating Israel. And as the late, our dear friend, Ambassador Richard Shifter said, these resolutions do the most serious damage in that each funds a program that would end the existence of Israel. Let's move forward if we can. We saw after Durban 9/11, but prior to Durban, we saw a shift from the diplomatic warfare back to not full battlefield, but to terror warfare. The first intifada in 1987, the second intifada launched in 2000. And so when we went to Durban, it was in the middle of the raging second intifada with suicide bombers. And out of Durban came the electronic intifada and the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. And it's now been discovered and proven that it's the designated foreign terror organizations, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PFLP, and others that are the manipulators of the boycott campaign. It's part of a conspiracy and a design. And included within that conspiracy and design was that in 2003, at the United Nations, a resolution was adopted referring a question to the International Court of Justice seeking an advisory opinion. What are the legal consequences arising from the construction of the wall known as the apartheid wall being built by Israel? That went to the International Court of Justice, and we objected to it. NGOs objected to it. Our law firm filed a brief, as you heard from Shoshana, on behalf of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a fabulous and important organization. We filed a brief arguing that Israel, like any other nation state in the world, has the right and the obligation to defend her people. And although there is this attempt at the UN and in the International Court of Justice to focus on Israel, isolate Israel, castigate Israel, the fact of the matter is every nation state has a primary obligation to defend and protect her people. And only Israel today is being denied that right. The 2004 advisory opinion was supposed to be just that. In the US, our courts don't issue advisory opinions. But the International Court of Justice issued an advisory opinion saying that Israel violated international law and talking about the settlements as a violation of international law, which has become quoted by everybody. Even US courts has been quoted as enforcing the concept that Israel is in violation of international law, but nobody can explain what international law Israel is really violating. There has indeed been a hijacking of international law. UN resolutions are not international law coming from the General Assembly. The advisory opinion is not international law. It's an advisory opinion, a biased advisory opinion that ignored the fact that Israel's courts were seized of the issues and in fact ruled that the root of the wall, which is only 4 to 6% a concrete barrier, the rest is a fence, a terror prevention security fence designed to fence out the terrorists, but it's ignored by the International Court of Justice. And let's see what we're facing even today at the International Criminal Court. Just a year and a half ago, proceedings commenced at the International Criminal Court against Israel with an examination into the presence of Israeli neighborhoods in the ancient lands of Judea and Samaria and in Jerusalem, and a criminal investigation into Israel on behalf of the foundation that we support, the Israel Forever Foundation. We argued in a brief to the International Criminal Court, the PA is not a state party. Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute and therefore should not be subject to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. That the PA itself lacks jurisdiction and the ability to delegate the dispute to the ICC, and that the referral was sought with unclean hands. Unclean because the date that they want the International Criminal Court to say that Israel is a criminal country is the day after, back in 2014, young kids were kidnapped and killed. They don't want responsibility for that. They want only the blame on Israel. Now the pretrial chamber has determined earlier this year that it has jurisdiction and the investigation has been commenced by the prosecution. The hijacking of international law and diplomacy is just part of the effort of the perpetuation of hate and the use of propaganda, the use of a multi-pronged propaganda. There's a perpetuation playbook that is utilized in this perpetuation of hate against Israel. It includes the refugees issues, includes victimhood. I've already talked about Zionism, racism. It includes calling Israel an apartheid racist criminal state. It includes alienation on the college campuses. It includes anti-Israelism, anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, and denial and distortion of the Holocaust. And it includes boycotts. This has a multi-pronged, multifaceted effort. And, you know, the use of propaganda is very clever. Palestinian Media Watch found a certain caricature of our friend, Prime Minister Netanyahu, putting him in Nazi garb. And this has been disseminated all over the Arab world as part of the Arab League-sponsored propaganda and the perpetuation of hate. We have to have a zero tolerance for anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, and Holocaust denial. We cannot let all these accusations, all this castigation go unchallenged. We have to move on together. We take a confluence approach, public policy, public opinion, and advocacy. We utilize the essential tools of the courts, the court of public opinion, public policy, and advocacy. We file lawsuits, as you know, and as you've heard, against state and non-state actors. And we go to Congress, and we go to the White House, and we go to the State Department using a confluence of litigation, legislation, public policy, and diplomacy. And sometimes we get some responses. I wrote to Secretary of State Antony Blinken when he first came into office, and I got a response, which I'm told was his first response to any of the Jewish leaders. And he wrote that he was committed and the Biden administration is committed. That's what was said in February. How it's playing out today is curious and concerning. Committed to Israel's security and to strengthening all aspects of the U.S.-Israel partnership, Holocaust remembrance, and countering anti-Semitism here at home and around the world. And further saying that the Biden administration enthusiastically embraces the 2016 International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism, including its examples. But we know that there are various efforts being taken by countries that remain as state sponsors, by organizations that remain as sponsors of terror, the PLO, the PA, Syria, Iran, banks, countries that are resisting efforts to hold them legally accountable. Move on, please, because we need to talk about, in the context of the Durban Hate Fest, we need to look at that last point, perpetuation and demonization, because that is the effort. And through the newest book, The Bloody Price of Freedom, we focus in on not just this history, but we focus in on the future. And I want to end with the fact that, as you'll see from the cover of The Bloody Price of Freedom, you will see what some think is the dove of peace. It's a dove flying over to Noah's Ark from a great artist from the Blue and White Gallery, Udi Marayos in Jerusalem, who gave us permission to use it on the cover. Because I do have hope. There's the hope that the Abraham Accords, brilliantly conceived during the Trump administration and put into place, maybe really is a change for the Arab League, because four countries of the Arab League, following what Egypt did, following what Jordan did, four countries of the Arab League, as we all know, have broken away. One of those countries, the UAE, seems to be taking the lead. I want to close with this. In 1979, the United States adopted legislation that created within the Department of Commerce the responsibility relating to resisting and monitoring the Arab boycott. The country that most appeared, I believe, every year on the list of violators was the UAE. Today, they have abrogated their commitment to boycotting Israel. Can we all work together? Can the Biden administration work together with the Trump administration legacy on the Abraham Accords, the recognition of Jerusalem, the rights historically of Israel in our ancient lands, and the right for Israel not to be held down and held back by those who seek Palestinian statehood, another subject, but rather take a look at the future of the region, take a look at the wonderful opportunities that regional stability can bring to all people, Arab Palestinians, Jews, Baha'is, Christians, Muslims, people from all walks of life. Let us hope that these Abraham Accords will be enhanced, and let us hope and believe that with hard work, all of us speaking up, calling for the advancement of relations between Jewish people and Muslims and Catholics and others. Let us hope that with the Christians who support us, with the Muslims who support us, with the Jews who support us, that governments around the world, including from the Arab League, will continue to break away and will finally recognize Israel's rich contribution to the world, the Jewish people's rich contribution to the world. And let us resolve as public policy thinkers, speakers, makers, and activists that we will work together to speak up proudly, to speak up directly, and to get our policymakers in Congress, in the State Department, in the White House, and around the world to stop the perpetuation of hate and to focus in on the perpetuation of good for the future of all people, Israel and all of her neighbors. Let regional stabilization become regional productivity, regional economic development, regional respect, regional tolerance. And let us work together to do what Israel has done since 1967, to guarantee freedom of access for people of all religions to all holy places, because indeed, Yerushalayim holds a special place for us and for all. Thank you very much.
Richard, thank you. It was an extraordinary overview of things that we need to know. Let me change continents. You talked about the Abraham Accords and the clear change in the region between the Abraham Accord countries and Israel, and the improvement of relations between Egypt and Israel and Jordan and Israel. Look at Europe for a moment, though. There also seems to be a split among European countries. The European Union no longer gets unanimous resolutions against Israel. It seems that some countries of Europe, particularly the Eastern countries, view Israel differently than France and Germany. Can you talk about that and see where we are there?
I think if you look at what just happened this week, it is the best sign of exactly what you're asking. Outgoing Chancellor Merkel from Germany, with no agenda, went to Israel in order to pronounce on behalf of the German people not only acceptance of responsibility, but a commitment to standing together against anti-Semitism, against anti-Zionism, against anti-Israelism. It's a responsibility, she says. I think she did that to be an example of one of the great countries of the world seeking to atone for their sins, accept responsibility, and leading today by example. Japan leads by example, standing with Israel. Other countries do so. It's sad that we're seeing countries like Poland turn against the issue of restitution. Poland denying its own responsibility for the Holocaust. How does all of this play out? We have seen over time a shift in different countries, some to the left and some to the right. We've seen that here in our own country. And for some reason, where Israel used to be unifying, even in our own country, we are finding a wide political divide. Europe is no different. And some people blame it on the Islamic influx into Europe. I don't blame it on that. I blame it on the fact that it has become all too acceptable to be anti-Semitic, all too acceptable to be anti-Israel, all too acceptable to say it's those Zionists, when they really mean it's those Israelis and those Jews. And not enough people are standing against it. And our young people aren't capable of doing it. We have failed in educating them. And the professors on the college campuses here and around the world, they're doing a terrific job turning the next generation against Israel. So I don't blame it just on European countries. Around the world, we have real problems. And I want to add something, if I may, Shoshana. You know, there's a herd mentality at the United Nations. It's one country, one vote. But there are alignments that go back decades. And we have worked to take UN ambassadors to Poland for Holocaust education and on to Israel. And some of them have changed their votes. But the ambassadors alone don't decide their votes. Many of them have to go to their presidents, their prime ministers, their foreign ministers. They are political appointees. So I think our challenge is a political challenge, both in Europe, in Africa, and in the United States. And that political challenge, in my view, needs a public policy, a friendliness, where we simply say, why is it that we are allowing the greatest democracy in the Middle East to be acceptably castigated? It makes no sense. But when people can get headlines speaking from Congress, as we know certain Congresswomen have done by speaking out at Congress, and they get great headlines, they keep doing it. We have a big challenge ahead, and I think the Jewish Policy Center can continue to play a major role in sensitizing people, in educating people, but also in creating an environment for nonpartisan public policy advocacy that will make people understand there is a whole conspiracy of this perpetuation of hate, and it has to stop. It cannot continue to be focused on one country being the one Jewish nation in the world.
So along those lines, we have a question from a listener. It says that you were pleased with the wording of the Blinken letter and stating President Biden's commitment to anti-Semitism, but then you said it was curious and concerning as to how those things are playing out. What concerns you?
Well, first, I was indeed pleased to receive the letter because Secretary of State Blinken, we all know, has a deep history with the Biden administration, with the Obama administration, with President Biden. And he came to this office with his own history. Part of that history is something very important. His stepfather, Samuel Pessar, was a survivor of the Holocaust. And it's ingrained within him to have an understanding of anti-Semitism, to have an understanding of Holocaust denial. And the fact that he took his opportunity to write to me and to recognize those commitments on behalf of the United States government, I applaud. Why am I concerned? I'm concerned because I don't hear enough applause coming from the Biden administration for the Abraham Accords. They should be fully embraced and not rejected merely because it was a Trump administration accomplishment. You know, in the United States, we've always built on our history in a positive way, fixing things that somebody might have done wrong. But we have to applaud that which was done right. And I focus on the Abraham Accords as being a sterling accomplishment of the president, the Secretary of State, Ambassador Friedman, coming from the White House, Jason Greenblatt, Jared Kushner, working across the board, working with Ambassador Dermer, working with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and working with governments that previously wouldn't even take a picture with an Israeli. And everything was underneath. Today, it's wide open. We must not only applaud that, we have to build on it because it is the key to peace. It's also the key, by the way, to changing the situation in Gaza. I just published an article on calling for a Gaza protectorate of countries including Arab League countries and including Egypt, that would indeed take a new approach in Gaza, because we can't let either Hamas or the PA continue to be responsible for the lives of over 2 million people packed into Gaza, who only know to hate because they have no other choice in their lives. It's what they've been taught from their textbooks, from UNRWA, from the political system. And there's not enough, in my view, being done by the current administration to stand against terror, to stand against hate, to stand against anti-Semitism, and to applaud the initiatives such as the Abraham Accords. They must embrace it, call it for what it is, a great accomplishment upon which we must build a better future.
That's a great answer to a question that I didn't ask, which is, what should we do? But apparently what we should do is make sure that our government and our representatives on the Hill and our senators and our president know what we want. So there's a message in there for us as individuals to carry forward. And I think that is a great note on which to thank you for an outstanding contribution to our understanding, a great perspective. And you did, you ended on a positive note, and I appreciate that, because as people who listen periodically know, that's my goal here. I want to end on a positive note. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us again. We will be on hiatus next week. We'll be back the week after, and we will be in touch with you in plenty of time to let you know who the next speaker will be on the JPC webinar series. In the meantime, Richard Heidemann, thank you.
Thank you, Shoshana, and thank you to everyone.